out. Maybe you have too much to do and you don't know how you're going to get it all done. Maybe you're looking for a job and you wish you had too much to do. Maybe you're in the middle of some relational conflict that is on your mind. Maybe you're lonely. Maybe finances are tight right now. We all face problems. We all have issues that concern us, but we don't often consider them as evil. Annoying, maybe, frustrating, maybe, but evil seems like a category for the big things. And yet we know that evil exists. We read about it. We see it out there. People who walk into movie theaters intent on murder. People in positions of authority who sexually abuse those they're supposed to protect. Military people that conscript children into their armies against their will. Women enslaved in the sex trade, even in the Bay Area. The big things seem like evil. The stuff in our lives seems small. And yet, even those things that we deal with day to day have their root in the same causes: pride, selfishness, ambition, competition, jealousy, hostility. It all starts from the same root. If we look closely, even the things we experience day to day are evil, and they affect us. Evil is everywhere. Well, this morning we're in our third chapter of our series as a church, Epic, The Astonishing Story of God and the World. We started out the first week, looked at the creation, and we looked at God's original good intentions for his creation. He meant things to be filled with life, and then we saw those intentions fall apart. We saw sin enter the world. In response, last week we saw God come up with a plan to save the world. He would start with individual men, start with heroes who would build a family, who would become a nation, who would save the world. We saw that God's heroes start small. We saw that they make mistakes, and we saw that they're characterized by their faith that God ultimately is the real hero. This week, we come to find a different piece of the story, how it fits together. Because we've seen that God wants to bring his creation back to what he intended, but there's something that stands in his way. In our first week, we consider the story of Noah. And it's this really horrific story of God destroying the world. This is what God says about why the world had to be destroyed. Here's Genesis 6:5. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. God saw that there was evil, and he wiped out the world to try to destroy it. But after the flood, God promises he won't do that again. Listen to what he says in Genesis 8:21. Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. So it didn't work. God wiped out the world, but even after the flood, every inclination of man's heart is still evil. God isn't going to destroy the world again, but not because things are fixed. Evil is still out there. So last week we saw God come up with this plan, but we still don't know, what is he going to do about evil? How will it be overcome? This morning, we get the answer. This morning, we look at a story of Joseph, the last story in the chapter of Genesis, the longest biographical story in Genesis. And Joseph's life, his story, reveals to us God's secret plan of how he intends to overcome evil. It's interesting, going back to Genesis and thinking about the creation has sparked a lot of questions for people that have asked me questions about God's original intentions. There have been things like, well, why did God create a world if he knew that people would sin? Or why did he even create the serpent? Or why make a tree that you can't eat from? All of these questions about the original heart of God, but they all come down to the same basic issue. How can God, a good God, allow evil to exist? It's one of the age-old questions of Christianity. And this question is a theological question, but it's also a personal one. How could God have let this happen to me? How could God allow this suffering that I'm going through, or that my loved ones are going through? And that's why Joseph's story is so helpful, because Joseph's story shows us both what God intends to do on a grand scale in terms of his purposes for creation, but it also shows us a story of a man who suffered and shows us what God does in the midst of that. So as we look at this story, we're going to see how God plans to overcome evil both in the world and in our own lives. Well, the story of Joseph starts out with a story of his father, Jacob. When God appeared to Abraham, he told him that he was going to become a great nation. His descendants would be greater than the stars of the earth. And Abraham had one kid. So Abraham's kid, Isaac, then had two kids. But finally, Jacob. We get to Jacob and he has 12 sons. The nation has begun. God renames Jacob Israel, and this great family that God has spoken of has finally come to light. But like any family, things aren't perfect in this family. Jacob makes it clear that Joseph is his favorite son. He buys him a fabulous coat to demonstrate this. And Joseph has these dreams, as younger brothers often do, of older brothers serving him. And he decides to tell his brothers about it, which of course causes them anger and jealousy, and eventually something breaks. All the other sons are off grazing the flocks, and Jacob sends Joseph off to them to check on them. And this is what happens. Here's Genesis 37. I'm going to start in the second half of verse 17. It's Genesis 37, verse 17. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. Joseph's brothers lay in wait for him out in the open fields, and they plotted to kill him. Sounds similar to another story we've heard. The first brothers we met in the biblical story had a similar situation. One of them was more favored by God. The other one got jealous, lay in wait, and killed the favored one. Here the brothers lay in wait, and they plan to kill him, but he narrowly escapes by being sold as a slave, which I suppose is somewhat better. Joseph is a victim of evil. Selling your brother into slavery is evil. I made a mental note in the first service to remind my children of that fact. This was supposed to be the family that was going to save the world. This was the family God was going to use to fix things. And yet, evil isn't just out there. Evil is in here. The very family that God was going to use to fix things is itself riddled with evil. This problem must be overcome. Well, the first step in overcoming evil is to identify it. That's what God did before and after the flood. He said, evil is everywhere in men's hearts. The narrator of this story wants us to see this scene and say, that is evil. That's just like Cain and Abel. Joseph himself, when we get to the end of the story, looks back and identifies this as evil. So the first step is to say, this is evil. Name it. Call it what it is. Call out evil. Sometimes we do this in our own lives. Sometimes we've suffered something. And often the first step in healing is to say, this has happened to me. To name it, to identify it, to call it what it is. This should not have happened. This was evil. Sometimes we do this for each other. Sometimes we experience things and our own perspective gets clouded. We need someone else to come in and say, what's happening here isn't right. This shouldn't be. That needs to change. This is evil. We need someone to call it out for us. But whether we're doing it for ourselves or others, sometimes we're hesitant to use this label victim. Victim implies weakness. Victim implies maybe that we're trying to escape our own responsibility. Being a victim implies that we don't have any power left. But the first step in moving forward is to say that something has been done against me. To recognize that as Joseph was a victim of evil, we are victims of evil as well. And once you've done that, it frees you up to then to say, okay, this or that has happened. What shall I do in response to it? What is my response going to be? Joseph's story starts out by forcing us to recognize evil and call it out. What makes Joseph interesting, though, is not just that he is a victim, but that he is an innocent victim. There's some debate about whether sharing his dreams with his brothers was prideful or arrogant. It was certainly unwise, but whether it was sinful is a debate. But at any rate, it didn't warrant the suffering that he received because of it. So Joseph is an innocent victim, but as we read on in the story, we find out he's more than innocent. He makes some decisions that are remarkable, given what he's been through. We left Joseph with some Midianite traders going to Egypt. They take him to Egypt and they sell him to a rich Egyptian named Potiphar. Joseph becomes a slave in his household, and he ends up rising to the top so that he is in charge of all the other slaves. This is what happens then as time progresses. Here's Genesis 39, starting in verse 6. Genesis 39:6. So he left, that's Potiphar, he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. That sounds pretty nice to me. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome, and after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day, he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me," he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Joseph is a good-looking guy. He's a hard worker. He eventually attracts the notice of Potiphar's wife. She comes on to him and he refuses, but finally it gets too much and she ends up framing him for assaulting her. He is sent to prison for something he doesn't do. Once again, Joseph is a victim. Once again, he's an innocent victim, but this time he's more than simply innocent. This time he is a righteous victim. This time he goes to prison, he goes into the pit for doing something, for doing the right thing, and that gets him in trouble. There's a great contrast between Joseph and his ancestors. If you remember his great-grandfather Abraham, twice Abraham protected his own hide by lying about his wife and subjecting her to being stolen into a harem. His grandfather Isaac actually did the same thing with Isaac's wife to the same king, Abimelech. But Joseph, when faced with this opportunity, refused it. He chose instead to put himself at risk, ending up in prison. As if being a slave in Egypt isn't bad enough, now he's a slave convicted of assault, stuck in prison. And this is what makes Joseph a remarkable character. Think about what normally happens in the world. Often, when people are victims of evil, they turn to evil themselves. They respond in kind. Becoming a victim of evil often leads people to become doers of evil. You see this in children. If one child hits another, which I rarely witness, but if one child hits another and you say, "Don't hit," then that child will invariably say, "But he took my toy," or "But she yelled at me," or "But something happened which justified my evil act." And yet, that's not true. Growing up, my parents would always use the phrase, "Two wrongs don't make a right," to say that the second wrong isn't justified by the first. Of course, I was a little sarcastic, so I would always say, "Two wrongs don't make a right, but three lefts do." You can figure that one out. It might take a while. So Joseph suffers evil, but given the opportunity, he doesn't respond in kind. He could easily have been mean or bitter or vindictive, but he's not. Instead, he is righteous. And this is our second encouragement then. We start off by calling out evil, but then, having suffered, having been the victim of evil, we choose not to return it. We refuse evil in turn. And this is really hard for us to do. It goes against our nature. When someone hits us, our response is usually to hit back, usually harder. Our tendency is to escalate the evil. And yet we don't have to. One of the most repeated phrases in the Old Testament is, "Vengeance belongs to the Lord." God's in charge of making things right. This is why Jesus says this in Matthew 5:39. "I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." Now, Jesus isn't saying here to welcome evil, to allow yourself to be a victim of evil. He too calls out evil, names it what he is. What he's saying is when you suffer evil, you don't have to do it in return. He models that, and Joseph models that. And in fact, that first step of calling out evil can free us up to refuse it when we have the opportunity. To be able to say, "This or that has happened to me, but now I can choose to respond with evil or to refuse it. It's inspiring to see Joseph do this, to refuse evil in response, and yet we still haven't really solved the problem of evil. What is God going to do about evil? It's still out there. So we pick up Joseph's story in prison. He's gained a reputation now as an interpreter of dreams. And eventually, Pharaoh starts having trouble sleeping. He has his own bad dreams. So he calls on Joseph to come and interpret his dreams. And Joseph tells him that God is explaining to Pharaoh what's going to happen in the future. Joseph says that his dreams reveal that there will be 7 years where the crops will be abundant, followed by 7 years of famine, where there will be a severe food shortage throughout Egypt. And Joseph wisely said, what you need is a smart guy to take you through this period. And Pharaoh says, you're right. How about you do it? So he brings Joseph out of prison and elevates him to the second highest position in the kingdom. Joseph will be in charge of all the resources of Egypt. The years of plenty happen. Joseph stores up food. And when famine hits, he is prepared to distribute food so that people's lives can be saved. Listen to how it's described in Genesis 41. I'm going to read verses 56 to 57. When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. And all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the world. Joseph saved Egypt from a devastating famine. The famine was, in fact, over the whole world, and everybody came to Egypt to buy grain. The Hebrew of the verse literally reads, "The whole earth came to Egypt to buy grain." So what can God do with a righteous victim? He can save the world. All the earth came to Egypt and was saved because of Joseph. Eventually, he saves his family too. His brothers come, and after some testing, he reveals himself to them. Then they bring his father, and the family of Israel is saved. Does this sound familiar? Joseph saved his family, he saved a nation, and he saved the world. This is what God promised to Abraham. It's a bit of a twist because the family itself needed saving, but finally we've seen the promise of Abraham start to come true in the story of Joseph. But we still don't quite understand how God got around the problem of evil. Well, Joseph clears it up for us in the last chapter of Genesis. He says something that ends up being really the theological hinge that the whole story of Joseph turns on. This is why God wants us to understand Joseph's story. This is the new thing that he's introducing. Listen to Genesis 50, verses 19 to 20. Joseph's brothers have come to him because they think he might still be mad at them. It's a fair thought. Their father has died, and they think he might try to exact vengeance. So he says this, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." So Joseph says to them, their intentions to harm ended up for good. The NIV actually has cleaned this up a little bit. The literally translation would be, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. Now, this is a remarkable idea. We're familiar with it, so we sometimes forget how remarkable it is. But this is the surprise of Joseph's story. Now, we know about good that turns into evil, the idealistic politician that ends up having to bend the rules to get his way. We know about evil people changing, the criminal who repents of all of his crimes and turns around and starts a new life. But this is a different category. This is something that was meant for evil, some true evil act that is itself used for good. That is something that only God can do. Up until now, we haven't seen him do this. When Adam and Eve encountered evil, he sent them away. When Cain performed evil, he sent him away. When the world was characterized by evil, he tried to wipe out evil. This is the new strategy of God. Here we see that God intends to take evil and change it into good. And this is what ends up being the strategy God will use to save the world. Joseph reveals God's purposes in a new way, and he becomes a little picture of what God plans to do in the future. If you've been listening closely, you may have seen some parallels between Joseph and a hero that's born about 2,000 years later. As a child, Joseph goes to Egypt to avoid being killed. Jesus does the same. Joseph is sold for the price of a slave. Jesus was too. Joseph is wrongly accused and declared guilty because of it. Jesus faced the same unjust accusations. Joseph began his service to Pharaoh when he turned 30 years old. Jesus began his ministry when he turned 30 years old. In Joseph's darkest moment, he was surrounded by two criminals, one of whom had a future to look forward to, one of whom didn't. In Jesus' darkest moment, he was surrounded by two criminals that had similar futures. Joseph goes from being a criminal in the pit to sitting at the right hand of the king. Jesus goes from being dead to sitting in power next to God the Father. At first, Joseph's brothers don't recognize him. Later, he reveals himself to them. After Jesus rises from the dead, even his disciples don't recognize him at first until he reveals himself to them. At the end of the story, Joseph is reunited with his father. And at the end of Jesus' ministry, he ascends to heaven to rejoin his father in heaven. But most of all, Joseph was an innocent, righteous victim. He suffered evil that he didn't deserve to suffer, but God used that evil to save the world. Apart from Joseph being in that Egyptian prison, the whole world would have perished. And yet God used it to save everyone. Jesus suffered evil of the worst degree. The Son of God punished unjustly. And yet God uses that evil act to save the world, to bring salvation, forgiveness, restoration to everyone. This is the brilliant strategy that God introduces here in Joseph's story that is unlike anything that exists in our world. God even says he himself will become a victim of evil and use it for good. Defeat becomes victory. I heard an audio interview where someone described it this way. The cross cannot be defeated because it is itself defeat. How can you beat something that when you beat it, has won anyway? And here we are introduced to God's secret weapon. God takes evil and turns it into good. That's called redemption. This is how God will conquer evil. Our final point is to recognize that and allow God to do that. We start off by calling out evil, identifying it. In response, we don't return evil, we refuse evil. Finally, we let God do what he does, redeem evil. Let God redeem evil. So this is the answer then to how God will solve the problem of evil in the world. But it also gives us an answer to why God created the world with the possibility of evil at all. It at least gives us part of the answer. Why would he create a world that would descend into evil? Well, if you read the whole story from beginning to end, as we're doing in this series, you realize that the end is described as better than the beginning. The new Jerusalem is more beautiful than the original Jerusalem. The tree of life in the center of the new city is more powerful than the tree of life in the garden. And so we realize that redemption is better than innocence. Redemption is better than innocence. Evil redeemed is better than evil unknown. One of the reasons that God created the earth, knowing that it would go into evil, is that on the other side of that evil, there is actually a better place. There is something worthwhile. God takes evil and makes it good. This often plays out in personal experience. It's frequently the people that have suffered the most, have seen the most evil, who are the most compassionate and understanding and sympathetic and willing to help others who have suffered. Facing evil and coming out the other side is a beautiful thing. It does something powerful. It changes people. It changes our experience. The biblical story suggests that it's better to see evil redeemed than to not see evil at all. Well, God's solution to the problem of evil in the world is also the solution of how we face it in our lives. We can allow God to redeem it. Now, sometimes we face evil that is devastating, and it can seem like there is no way that God could use this for any amount of good. But we believe in a God that does the impossible. Surely Joseph in an Egyptian prison could not have imagined how God would use his circumstances. And yet he ended up using them to save the world. We need to trust that God will redeem evil in our lives. As we suffer things, as we go through things, we know that we believe in a God that does the impossible and turns evil into good. Well, in these first few chapters of the epic story that we've been following, we've seen an enormous amount of material. We started out and seen God creating something for good, God's good intentions. We've seen those intentions fail, fall away. So we saw God come up with a plan to solve things. He was going to do it through heroes, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, now Joseph. And today we've seen the strategy he's going to use. The method is by taking that evil out there, taking it on himself, and making good out of it. That's what happens to Joseph, and that's what Jesus eventually does. One of the things that amazed me about being a parent and seeing my kids grow up is observing what happened in that first year of life. Now, when babies are born, they are completely helpless. Left alone, even for a few hours, they probably wouldn't survive. And yet in that first year, they start to learn to pick up food and put it in their mouth. They start to learn to move around. Many babies by year one are walking. They learn to communicate, ask for what they want. A lot of kids by year one are talking. And I remember thinking when my kids hit 1 year old, I looked at them and thought, you know, they've really learned all there is to learn. They're walking, they're talking, they're eating. All the basics of life, they've got. From now on, it's just getting better, right? Move a little faster, talk a little better, eat a little more interestingly. And that's what we see here. In this first two eras, as we get to the end of Genesis, we see that all the pieces of the story, all the ways that God is going to work in the world, are there. We've seen one man save the world. We've seen God's desire to return creation to its original state. We've seen the power of redemption, of evil turned to good. And as we continue in the story, we're going to see that play out in richer and deeper ways. A new hero arises. He builds a different kind of family. That's us. And we turn into a people that saves the world. So we've seen where it started, we've seen what happened, we've seen who God intends to use to fix it, and today we've seen how God intends to fix it. Next week we'll look at Moses, and we'll see another story that demonstrates God's entire plan played out in a small way to grant freedom to a people that needs desperately to be freed. And we'll see for ourselves how that connects with us and how much we need to be freed. So we'll see you next week. Pray with me. God, thank you thanks that you do the impossible. You take evil and you turn it into good, something we can't even imagine how it works, and yet something that is so central to the way you work in the world. Help us to trust you for that with the evil we see in the world and the evil we see in our own lives. And we pray this in the name of your Son, Jesus, who took on evil so that good might be done for us. Amen.